Welcome to the State of the Markets podcast. I'm Paul Rodriguez of thinktrading.com.
I'm Tim Price of pricevaluepartners.com.
And our very special guest is David Hunter. David Hunter, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Paul.
So, between us, we've probably got over, I would say, 120 years worth of market experience, but you're the daddy here with 50 years. I feel like a newbie.
A spring chicken.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, it's one of the good sides of being old, I guess, is you have experience, but otherwise, yeah, we're the old guys.
Absolutely, absolutely. So you started out in the markets in 1973. What got you involved in the markets in the first place?
Sure. Yeah, I was a finance major in college, and back then, you're my contemporary, so I think you understand this, but it was a rarity when I entered college. Most people were entering college to avoid the draft, and they didn't really know what they wanted to do. So they were what we called back then hearts and flowers majors, you know, mostly liberal arts. I decided right out of high school I wanted to major in finance. It interested me. And so 4 years of you know, business and finance background, and I guess probably halfway through or junior year, I decided I really wanted to get into the investment field. So, you know, I knew pretty early on, and, you know, really once I got in there, I never wavered. It was, you know, it was clearly what I wanted. So
what was the composition of that course, David? I mean, the reason I ask is because my brother, who is singly responsible for the global financial crisis, read economics at Cambridge. So he was ground zero. It was his fault. But what kind of course was it? I mean, I'm a fan of Austrian school economics, but was it Keynesian or classical? What was the bias?
Yeah, well, it was finance, so it was really more away from the economics. I was a finance major, economics minor, I guess, and then did an MBA with finance emphasis also. But yeah, my economics in college, in undergrad, was pretty straightforward. You know, you did your micro and macro and you know, a few other courses. But it was in graduate school where I was fortunate. One of my courses was taught by a university. I went to DePaul in Chicago. One of the courses was taught by a professor who was from the University of Chicago, and it was a macro course. And so even though he said, my whole job is to make sure you don't know whether I'm a Keynesian or a monetarist, you know, to teach you both sides. But he was so good at it. It was, you know, I basically am a monetarist at heart. Mm. So
did you find that education actually helped you, or did you have to develop your own methods? From what I understand, you use multiple forms of analysis. And if I could just tie this question into it, when did you feel most comfortable with your overall investment thesis? I don't know whether anybody ever feels 100% comfortable, but
right.
I feel like the pieces were together and you were confident in your ability to predict the markets in a way that worked for you.
Yeah, you know, certainly the education you get with all the courses in finance, with all the courses in, you know, accounting and economics, you come in with certainly a base to work off of, but really investments is something you learn on the job. You know, like you look back and the things you thought you knew coming in, and you didn't know squat, you know? So, so it's really a cumulative effort. I feel my first probably few years, you're just kind of going along. You're impressed by what you hear from the, you know, the so-called experts, et cetera. But I was a contrarian pretty early on. I think it comes naturally to me. So I coming in 1973, it was a top of the Nifty 50 market. And so I very quickly then got into the, you know, 73, 74 bear market. So I learned very early on the importance of risk management, capital preservation. And I think that served me very well through the years. you know, again, I'm naturally contrarian. I gravitated to the value side of investing pretty fast. And that kind of fit in with, you know, looking out for your downside as well as your upside returns.
How much of the current market environment feels, with the magnificent so-called Magnificent Seven, feels like the top of the Nifty 50?
Not really yet, at all. You know, that was I don't know if you guys are, have ever studied that period, but it was pretty amazing. Everybody, that managed, you know, most of the pension money that was managed back then was concentrated in the New York banks. So the managers all went to lunch together, all heard the same stories together. You know, they got caught in the, obviously the one decision, the whole story was it's a one decision stock. These are all big blue chip, you know, American companies that are the backbone of the economy. And you only have to know, you know, you only have to buy them. You don't have to worry about selling them. And that's what drove the Nifty 50 to the top. There are some similarities, certainly, in terms of this thing is getting longer in the tooth. And we're at the end of what I call a 41-year secular bull market that started back in 1982. So even though I have, you know, people know that I'm out there calling for 7,000 on the S&P, so still, you know, 40% away, I think that's coming in a matter of months. So we're getting to the end of a 41-year bull market. So from that standpoint, yeah, it's similar. But the makeup, I'm not one of those that believes the market's going to stay narrow right to the top. I've been saying for a while now that the last stage of this are going to be somewhat unusual, and that's the typical way it goes, is as you go towards the top, markets narrow. I think this thing's going to broaden out and you're going to actually have a broad rally into the top.
So what makes you feel that we still have more to go going back? You said, was it from the 80s? So it started in the 80s.
Right.
Why in the 80s, and why do you feel we're now nearing the end? Because there's been plenty of times when one could have said we've hit the end of this, and the markets just kept going up. You know, 2008 was a big one. 2020 was another one. Of course, the big one hasn't happened. But what makes you think that the next big correction will be the correction?
Right. The reason I dated back to 82 is that's really the start of the disinflationary trend that we got. You know, we peaked inflation out at just over 20%, and it started coming down gradually and then faster later on in the decades to come. But it basically is what drove us from, you know, I remember the Dow back then. I remember what the S&P was at in August of 1982, but the Dow was bottomed, I think, at 782 or 780, somewhere around there. And of course, you know, we've come to 35,000 plus. So what drove that move was certainly earnings, but the biggest driver was the fact that as disinflation came into being, inflation came down, interest rates followed inflation down, and we went from 15% long bond down to, or 15% 10-year down to almost zero. So PE multiples are the inverse of that. So we've had this big expansion of PE multiples. So that kind of is the way I see the whole secular move, is that it was driven by disinflation and that we're coming to the end of that. One way or the other, we obviously had this ratcheting up of inflation the last couple of years. But I think ultimately this will end in deflation, and then we'll start a new inflation cycle. So that's the start and why I think this is all one big secular bull market. Within that, you've had cyclical bull markets. So certainly, you know, the 2008 was the bottom bear market, and started in 2009, started a new cyclical bull. And before that, 2003 to 2008, and before that, we had you know, several cyclical bulls within a secular bull. The reason I think we're topping out is because I think we are coming to the end of that long disinflation cycle. I thought it could have ended in the market that we had after the pandemic. And I called a melt up in March of 2020 when everybody was bearish, and called for 4,000 and expanded it to 4,800 and beyond during that 2-year rally. In December of 2021, I said the market's needing a breather. You know, it's going to correct. I didn't expect the bear market we got in 2022, but I did expect a 10-15% correction. And I looked at the bear market in 2022 and said, no, this thing's not done. You know, you have not completed this thing. And surprisingly, melt-ups are very rare. People throw around the term melt-up, but melt-ups are what we saw in the Nifty 50. It was basically a melt-up in 73. What we saw in 2000 in the NASDAQ was a melt-up, but they are very rare. I've used the term melt-up. I'm kind of the author of it, you know, not that it's a unique term, but in terms of these cycles now, I've been talking about it for the last, you know, 3, 4, 5 years. So all in, and because I'm on Twitter so much, I think a lot of what you're seeing in terms of the term melt-up or the term bust are both coming from my calls. But people are using them in different ways. So the melt-up that people, when people say melt-up, lots of times they're talking about a 10% rally or, you know, a big rally. Melt-up is a very unusual rally that goes vertical ultimately into the end. And I don't think we've gone to that parabolic part of the melt-up yet. I think the melt-up began back at 4,100 back in October. And so we're in the melt-up, and I think it's going to steepen from here into a parabolic.
So that sounds like the Austrian school economics end of the currency when everything just explodes. But before we talk about perhaps what will happen in the future, I'm curious as to when interest rates hit zero and bond yields were yielding nothing and negative, why didn't you feel that was potentially the low and then we'd get inflation from there, which seemed to be a very... well, the Fed wrong-footed everybody by saying there's no inflation, then suddenly yanked up interest rates, which is another issue. But it seemed like we couldn't go any lower. It's the only way is up from here. It has been up. Why are we not already in an upward trend in interest rates and inflation?
So first of all, the reason why the cycle got extended is $5 trillion coming out of the Fed. I mean, that does a lot, and you know, similar coming out of the government in terms of debt, and you know, similar around the world. So that extended the cycle. I think the parabolic really didn't cleanse the system, but it really stretched the cycle. And so why inflation? Why not inflation now? I actually think the Fed is over tightening here. And that we're going to, and that's why I call for a global bust following this melt up. The problem is you have $320 trillion in debt around the world, and you have quadrillions in notional value of derivatives. The debt is obviously leverage on the system. The derivatives are leverage on the markets. And I just think we've got a Fed and central banks around the world that are managing policy, looking at backward indicators, and they are, inflation has probably a 2-year lag, and they want to see the whites of the eyes of the 2% inflation before they're going to stop. That's a recipe for disaster. As I say, the Fed makes, you know, overstays are welcome on the easy side and the tight side all the time, every cycle. That's why we have booms and busts. But when you've got that kind of leverage in the system, we were not even there in 2008-9. We had leverage, plenty of leverage then. We are way beyond that leverage now. When you have that kind of leverage, or when the Fed makes a mistake or the central banks make a policy error, it's bad enough. When you have that kind of leverage and they make a policy mistake, you really, you know, things go down fast and hard. So I think we're going to see, as I say, 2008-09, we came close to what I term a bust. I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but if you remember when the commercial paper market froze up and GE was rumored to be going under, they couldn't fund their debt. And the government and the Fed acted pretty fast, unfroze that market, and we avoided the bust, because if they had moved any slower, we were probably going to see the bust last, that cycle. So the difference between 2008-09 and now is I think we go over that cliff this time. And there are a number of reasons for it, but you know, the Fed's fighting the last war is one of them. So I think that we're, you know, I'm in a very schizophrenic place in that I'm calling for the biggest rally in history, and then shortly thereafter, you know, something that hasn't happened in the post-World War II era in terms of the downside. I mean, it just sounds crazy, and there's certainly lots of people that think I'm crazy with this call, but it's just where we are in history, I think.
I would say that doesn't sound crazy at all, because at the end of any major reversal, you get this parabolic move. And we've seen strong moves to the upside, but we haven't seen a parabolic move as yet. And therefore, it makes perfect sense that you would have this phase, this kind of what I call the convincing phase, where everybody who's like out of the markets, I know you use sentiment indicators, or you look at sentiment. Obviously, what we have the expression here, it does what it says on the tin, and that's your Twitter handle is what it says on the tin, because you are a contrarian, and the markets are very, very bearish at these points, which it doesn't seem like it, but it is. Now, I look at certain technical indicators that show the percentage of people who are bullish against bearish, and 70% or more are bearish the market. So we haven't got to that point when everybody's suddenly flipping, going from 70% bullish to kind of 90%, sorry, 70% bearish to 90 to 95% bullish. You need that final phase. And that only happens when things just go crazy. It reminds me of the dot-com boom, you know, when people were leaving their jobs as nightclub bouncers and teachers and doctors just to go into the market. And you know that that's the end. And we haven't really got that as yet. It's not on the front page of the newspapers as to, you know, how these good times are rolling. It's still the opposite. What do you use for your sentiment indicators? Because you can obviously use the commitment of traders data, but do you use anything other than just kind of sentiment on Twitter and things like that?
Yeah, certainly. I warn people against, particularly on my feed, looking at my feed and thinking that's sentiment, because I go, you know, it's very biased towards my view on, obviously, for the followers on my feed. And so everybody's kind of playing this melt up and they're nervous as heck. So some of it is feel, you know, doing this for 50 years and through many cycles. Some of it is feel. I certainly look at it, you know, investors' intelligence numbers or the commitment of traders or the Bank of America portfolio manager survey. You know, there's other sentiment indicators out there, but the one thing that's been, I think I've read pretty well, and I think people get it wrong. You just stated correctly what I don't think a lot of people understand, which is, in spite of being at, you know, 5,100, you know, a huge percentage of money managers are still defensive, you know, whether they're in cash, whether in defensive stocks, whether in bonds. They still have fought this thing. You know, I turned bullish I was bullish coming into it, but I was very bullish in October of 2022 and watched people fight that thing and say this is a bear market rally, and, you know, every couple hundred points saying this is the top and it's going to roll over and go to new lows. They did that all the way to 4,300, broke above 4,300. I said, yeah, maybe it can run to 4,600. And I did call that pullback to 4,100. And but then you got down there and people are again back to, you know, the sky's falling, this thing's going a lot lower, whether it's going to new lows or going back to the October 22 lows. What I saw consistently was it took very little rollover, just like yesterday, to have people coming out of the woodwork bearish. As I described, because once we got to 4,600 and above, you know, on our way to 5,100, people are going, people are sounding like you now. Aren't you ready to turn bearish? You're contrarian. Everybody's bullish now. I go, watch. You know, there's no conviction in that bullishness. I use the term, they're just caught up in the momentum of the tape. You know, sentiment follows the tape. And so they get more bullish as it goes up, but they have no conviction on that bullishness. And you see it, you get one day rollover and they get nervous that this thing's going a lot lower. So I think there's a huge wall of worry that will continue to fuel this rally.
Do you think the rise of ETFs is partly responsible for these trends? Because a lot of investment managers aren't even human now, they're just algorithms.
Yeah, I think ETFs, algorithms, all of that, not to mention, you know, so many retail investors are, whether it's through CNBC and Bloomberg or whether it's, you know, all the things online, they really aren't investors. They come in as traders. You know, I made the comment yesterday. It's, you know, to somebody, I said, they may as well be, I think they look at stocks the same way they look at FanDuel. You know, it's a very short term mentality, and everything is driven by, you know, short term technicals. So certainly ETF, it's an easy thing to get in and out of, so people are more prone to that.
So the market got shaken up slightly. I mean, I say shaken up, we had a down day by the CPI number that came out yesterday. So we're recording this on the 14th of February, Valentine's Day. And yesterday the CPI number came out at, what was it, 3.1 instead of 2.9, but it's going down. I mean, it's like the trend is down for the CPI. Yeah. So showing that there's not much inflation in the system, and the market sort of threw a hissy fit, the dollar rallied, everything sort of, it seemed to be like a really big, big move. But actually, if you look behind it, it wasn't. And if you looked at the way the bond market reacted, which I think is the most important, it's not really, I mean, the dollar move was fairly big, but it's not that big. And the yield move wasn't significant. I don't think there's any conviction behind reversing yields going potentially back down again. And the curve for a interest rate cut this year is on. And that kind of supports the fact that the market should continue to go up. So I just wonder whether that was what you thought of that. Was that your, in terms of short-term analysis of what's just happened?
Yeah, I thought it was a bit of an overreaction, but it was clearly people were coming into that print, into that data release, thinking we're going to get good news on inflation and it's going to be off to the races. And they got the opposite, not terrible, but just the opposite. And so with people all positioned for better and got worse, they just, you know, they took that ball and ran with it. And I saw a lot of things basically that had gapped up the couple of days before just went back and filled in gaps. So, I think it was. But of course, what it did do is it caused people to then say, see, we're going to get, even for the people who aren't bearish but are looking for a better entry point, you know, we're going to get 5 or 6% correction here. You know, the market's overdone. That's the other thing, is I think people are so caught in the narrative that we have a magnificent seven market and nothing else. And I go, look at industrials, they're at all-time highs. Look at home builders, they're at all-time highs. You know, look at a lot of groups have done well. And meanwhile, you know, the Russell has lagged, but it looked like prior to yesterday, like it had concern. What people don't understand is you had a amazing November, December, a very strong market, you know, market moved 20% or whatever. And what you've seen in the last month or 6 weeks in a lot of groups, including the Russell, was a consolidation of that strength. You know, you things have to consolidate after a big run, but they only gave back part of it, a normal part of it. And then, you know, the Russell, for instance, had turned back up and looked like it was ready to head to new highs. And then you got yesterday. But yesterday just kind of brought it back in and filled in the gap, I think. So my, you know, I totally disagree with the narrative that it's a magnificent seven market, and that it's, you know, a sign of a very poor quality market. I think you're going to see a lot of breadth here. Industrials, a lot of the materials groups, I think, are coming alive, or you know, are ready, poised to come out of consolidations. So I think there's a lot of groups that will fill in here, and it doesn't mean that the Magnificent Seven or the large cap tech are going to stop going up. I just think they're going to be joined by others. So I've been big on semiconductors all the way through the last 2 years, and you know, they've had a great run. I think they still have, you know, SMH looks to me like it's still got, you know, 50% upside from here. So,
wow, that is a call. So, Tim, did you want to ask something here?
I was just going to ask David, how does that relate to, I mean, something that's very dear to my heart and our clients' heart is gold and silver miners, which we've owned for quite some time, but which have been languishing for the last couple of years. Do you see those turning around anytime soon?
Yeah, let's put it this way. Yesterday, I took it on the chin some more, but I've been a bull on the miners and the metals, and I still think gold's going to break out here shortly and go to 3,000 pre-bust. And that's what I use as my timing. It's not, I don't know what month or, you know, even what quarter, but pre-bust, I have a target of 3,000 on gold and a target of 60 on silver in that same time frame. And I've said that it might even move through 60 to 75. That seems ridiculous right now with silver at 22. And certainly the miners have been beat up very badly these last couple of years. So I hear from a lot of people saying, yeah, your melt-up call is amazing, but boy, you've done a terrible job on the metals and miners, or particularly the miners. I think you're bottoming. I mean, I think this thing is very near a big turn. I keep saying it's dependent on the dollar rolling over. I have a dollar call DXY going to 80, and that's what it's going to take for, you know, my targets, I think. So it's just sometimes markets take their time. In this case, you know, we had a very strong dollar, and you know, a couple of years ago came down sharply, and we've spent, you know, we've had a couple of counter trend rallies here just because too many people became believers in the downside, I think. But I do still think the dollar's, you know, rolling over, I think, as we speak, and should head for probably next stop mid 90s and then 90. And then once it breaks 90, I think you'll see 80 fairly quickly.
You mentioned, I hear what you say about market breadth and that you expect things to broaden out, but I think I'm right in saying that the market cap of Microsoft and Apple combined is 70 times the value of all mining companies, in certainly in the US, if not the world. It's like a staggering proportion. I don't know what that ratio should be. It probably shouldn't be 70.
No, yeah. I think, again, what I say to people is, my melt-up call to, you know, S&P 7,000, NASDAQ 23,000, Russell 3,300, you know, Dow 55,000, does not mean I'm endorsing that as a good value. I'm not saying it deserves to be there. It's just we still have a lot of money sloshing around from the pandemic, and we had everybody get to one side of the boat, you know, back a year ago, a year and a half ago. You know, a lot of those people, I think, are going to, in a concentrated period of time, come into this market and, you know, create that parabolic run. And you get sort of a buying stampede, where you get a big price move, not necessarily rational, although people will rationalize, you know, rationalize the move. And say, this is why I think it can still go, just like NVIDIA now, or, you know, Microsoft, as you say. But on the other side of the mountain, I'm calling for an 80% bear market. So it's not that this is deserved or, you know, is fundamental. I just think it's where we're going.
On the silver call, I think that's a really interesting one, because if for anyone who doubts that as a possibility, they should go back and have a look at what happened in 2010 when silver was trading around $18 and then took off towards, well, within a year, it was trading at $50. So that is the sort of thing that this compression from a technical point of view looks like we're building up to, because gold has been, you know, flirting with new highs, trying to break new highs, and it just feels like it really wants to go. Silver's just, it feels like it's also just being held back by something. And you know, yes, when everything starts going, it's just going to take off. And I, to be honest, I, before Christmas, I was like saying, yeah, this is it. Feels like it's going to go, really nice little technical pattern. And it went up and it just came back into that range again. So I've seen that happen a few times where it tries to break out, doesn't, and then when it goes, it's like no one can jump on it because it's going so fast that it just does not give you that chance to come back.
And yeah, it's one of those people don't realize the mining industry. If money managers ever decide, you know, we need that 5% in miners, I mean, this is such a very small cap group now. I mean, there's very little capitalization of miners out there. You know, it'll blow the top off. So it's very hard when you're at, and I keep saying this to people, I go, I got the same treatment, you know, back in October 2022 or the summer of 2022 when I was, you know, talking about the equity market, because they keep going, well, you know, your equity market call was a lot. It wasn't this difficult. I go, it was. You don't realize how beat up I got for being bullish when everybody was bearish. And I go, that's, you know, you're seeing it here. I have guys saying to me, gold hasn't done anything in 40 years. I go, do you realize gold went from 250 to 1900 in the first decade of this century? Mm. Do you have any idea that silver went from, you know, a buck to 48 or a couple bucks to 48? I mean, it's just, they have no memory of it because it's been such a difficult trade for a number of years. You know, we had a strong 2016. We had an amazing couple months coming out of the, you know, the lows in the pandemic. You know, what we saw in April, May, June, July of 2020 were big moves. Other than that, it's been, you know, it's just killed people. So I think you have, you know, sentiment at rock bottom, and nobody expects anything, and they can't come up with a bullish story. And I keep saying, you know, I'm bullish on bond, I'm bullish on the, and I'm bearish on the dollar, I'm bearish on interest rates. You get interest rates down sharply and you get the dollar down sharply, and that's a recipe for the, you know, the metals.
I had the feeling that maybe something had to come into the system to make the Fed cut interest rates to make the dollar go down. And I'm kind of putting the cart in some ways before the horse, because I look at things technically and it looks like this is what's coming. And I'm trying to think of what could possibly be out there that would make this happen, if that makes sense. And I just wondered whether you feel that there could be something, like, for example, in the UK, we have a retail chain called The Body Shop, and it's gone.
We used to have a retail chain called The Body Shop.
Used to have one. Yeah. They're just trying to save it. And So that's, I mean, that's obviously not good news. So there are things that are bubbling off in the background that is bad news. And I'm sure the markets will shrug it off because that's how it's looking like it, you know, the underlying macro themes. But there are problems. And a bank is going to take a big hit on that. There would be some lending and all that sort of stuff. So I'm just wondering, do you think there's a possibility that we will have another shoe to drop in terms of the banking sector, perhaps in America? Or maybe elsewhere, that would then get the Fed to go, whoa, hang on, let's forget about this, you know, this 2% target. Let's just get interest rates as low as we can as quickly as possible.
Yeah, I definitely think that's coming in the bust. I don't know whether, you know, I don't know what we're getting. I keep telling people, my bullish call on the equities does not depend on the Fed cutting rates. That I think they may cut rates this spring, but it's not dependent on that, because I go, the bond market is, bond market moves before the Fed. The bond market is, I'm pretty confident in calling lower rates. I think you'll see a 2.5% 10-year at the peak in the equity market. So during this melt up, I think you could move to 2.5. During the bust, I think the 10-year can move to zero or negative rates. During the bust, I think short rates will go negative. So I'm the rare guy out there today that doesn't think we've seen the low in the secular move in rates. I think we have one more lower low. And it's because the economy is going to be so, but the financial system and the economy is going to be so bad. But getting back to
that's post bust. Sorry to cut in, but it's really important. So in terms of timing, that is post bust, not this year.
The move to 2.5 is in the next 6 months, The move from there, then you might get a backup in rates for a little while after you have that move. And then the move down to zero or below on the 10-year and probably a quarter to a half on the 30-year and definitely negative rates on the short rates. That happens in the bust as the central banks are having to react to a financial system in free fall. And that's what I call a bust. A bust, unlike 2008, I think this time they're going to be slow to react. They've already told us they don't want to do what they did in 2008 again, or in 2020 again. They're not going to do QE like that again. I guarantee you, when they're faced with things free falling, they're not going to be worrying about inflation at that point, or what a Fed put looks like, or whatever. They're gonna be saying, we got to save the system, and there's only one tool at that point that they can do quickly, and that's money. I think you'll see, not to jump ahead, but I think you'll see $20 trillion come out of the Fed. So we did $5 trillion in 2020, 2021. I think we'll see four times that. And in terms of, monetary expansion.
Would be consistent with the dollar completely, let's say, coming under the cosh.
Yeah, it's funny because I'm getting away from the original question. So I know I do this, but I think you're going to have a move this year and the first three quarters this year in the dollar down to 80. That's before all this money is created. When the money's created, ironically, I think the dollar is going to be the flight to safety during the bust. So you can go back to 120 or above as a final hurrah on the dollar. And I think later in the decade, the dollar could be below 50. But so the dollar may be going up while they're printing money, because every central bank's going to be doing the same thing. And I think people are going to run to the dollar as they always do in crisis. So the move down to 80 is not dependent on flooding the system with money. It's really, I think you're right. I mean, currencies are technically driven. I think technically it looks like it's going there. What could move it there? I do think, going back to your original thought, I do think there's a decent chance, and I have to caution, because people get mixed up between a scenario and a forecast. My forecast is clear. There is a scenario I can draw where the Fed does start easing this spring, before May or June, and maybe even March, but certainly sometime this spring, where, because the economy is weaker, because we're caught in this game of, they got all excited about the labor numbers last Friday. Yeah. Most of the gains were part-time jobs. Our full-time jobs continue to decline. The economy is not in good shape. We see it in delinquencies. We see it in, there's a have and half not economy. So the haves are spending like crazy still. Their investments are all up. Their homes are at full value, and they've got jobs, so they're spending. But there's another half of the population that's barely getting by, And, you know, they're having to use their credit cards to buy groceries because groceries have gotten so expensive they can't keep it in their budget. You know, those are all bad signs that we're coming to an end. And yet the Fed is focused on a lagging indicator, labor, and another lagging indicator, inflation, fighting the, you know, the inflation, which, you know, by the time they conquer inflation, you're 2 years too late in terms of easing, or a year too late, at least. And labor's a, you know, gonna roll over later. If you should not be using that to determine policy. So I think, you know, I think what they're doing is all wrong. I defend Powell. It's funny because I've been a big critic of his over the years, but I defend him in this way. I go, you know, I thought we'd see recession before now. I thought he was overly tight sooner than this. You know, up till now, you can't fault him. He's, you know, he's been right in terms of, if you look at the, measure him by what we're looking at right now. My problem is, by the time they realize they're wrong, it's way too late. So, you know, I do think he's making an error, but you're not going to know it yet, or you don't know it yet.
You've alluded to food and to the economy. To what extent, if any, does politics form an input into your process?
Yeah, in this particular cycle, I don't think a lot. Here's where I do defend Powell. I do not think the Fed is political, overly political. I mean, they have to be a little bit. Yeah, I'm sure they're getting some pressure from Brainard and Yellen and, you know, Biden spokespeople in terms of saying you gotta help us here. But I think generally, Powell and his fellow governors are really focused on the economy and the system, and are trying not to be, you know, not to get in the way of the election. You know, at some point, as we get closer to November, you know, meaning late summer, they may just feel we can't do anything, and that could be a problem. But you know, or, you know, without appearing political, but at this point, I don't think politics is really what's going on here. You know, I think. Powell is, you know, paying attention to something he shouldn't, and that is the stock market. Yeah, I've said over and over, he bought hook, line, and sinker into Dudley's view that, you know, stock market's a big part of financial conditions, and that needs to, you know, I think he alluded to it needs to get down under 3,000 on the S&P. And I think for the next year after that speech in April of 2022, you could see Powell, every time the market lifted its head, out came his cronies, out came his fellow governors, you know, jawboning the market. And he kept trying to do it, and the market kept going higher. So finally, earlier last year, he gave up, and at least wasn't as obvious about it. He still made his efforts in his, you know, post-Fed meeting speeches, you know, he would, or commentary, he would, you could tell he was still trying to keep the market at bay, didn't want it to run away. And I think that was some of what, you know, happened last week, is, you know, his rhetoric was, I just don't think he likes the market up here, and it's because he bought into Dudley. I think it's so wrong. As I've said, Fed governors should not be focused on the stock market. You know, they are the last people I'd expect to know where the market should be, and they should not be deciding where it should be. And obviously they can't control the market anyway. So, but I do think that that is something that could play a role here. If we get my forecast and we go to S&P 7,000, on the way to 7,000, somewhere above 6,000, I believe, let's say the Fed has done a cut or not, but let's say it might have cut, you know, this spring. If by, let's say, middle of the year, we're above 6,000, they may take that cut back and hike some more just on the basis that they really think they have to control the stock market. They may look and say, you know, there's just too many animal spirits out there. You know, the risks are getting away from us. We, you know, and that's going to lead to inflation getting heated up again, and they could, that could be the final policy error that kind of breaks this, the camel's back in terms of, you know, hiking on the eve of, you know, an economy that's very fragile and could roll over pretty quickly.
I suppose the reason I asked the question about politics is really for geopolitics, that from the perspective of a Brit watching what's happening in America, you have a serving president that seems to be visibly suffering from dementia. The optics look dreadful. You have war in, a proxy war in Ukraine. You have basically what looks like war in the Middle East, like possibility of war in Asia and South Asia, maybe Taiwan. And, you know, the Biden administration doesn't exactly seem to be unhappy about funding all of this kind of stuff. So I guess that touches back on the dollar again, which is, if you have an administration that's already $34 trillion in the hole, and it's just writing checks left, right, and center to pay for foreign wars and foreign adventuring, now, something's got to break sooner or later.
And by the way, not only that, but we're spending so much additional money on the invasion into this country. I mean, tens of millions of people coming in and being put on the dole. Nobody's talking about MMT, but they're certainly practicing it, right?
Sure.
They seem to think that money grows on trees and you can do this forever. My scenario beyond the melt up and beyond the bust is one of saying that, you know, the Ponzi scheme comes to an end. The scheme that's been in place since the Great Depression, so 80 years plus, will come to an end, I think, early next decade.
So will we have a new currency then? Could there be a whole new regime? Because I'm guessing you're not a fan of cryptocurrencies, but what if they try to bring in a CBDC in order to get everybody back into a new system and let the old system crash, sort of thing? I my view is that's the only way they're ever going to do it, if they're going to do it, because people would not naturally want to take on a CBDC.
Here's and this is probably a good time to respond to what you mentioned before about the Austrians. I am not at all in the Austrian camp, and only from the standpoint probably of timing. The Austrians tend to think, as you said before, that this is the peak and then we crash, the beginning and the end begins right after that. I believe there's one more cycle, because this bust is going to be a deflationary bust, temporary, short-term deflation, but, for maybe a year you might have deflation.
And no heavily indebted government can afford deflation.
And so in the face of a free-falling financial system and deflation, you're going to get, as I said, $20 trillion coming out of our Fed and proportionally similar out of the ECB and the Bank of England and Bank of Canada and Australia and probably even People's Bank of China. So you're gonna see money like we've never seen, and it gives you one last cycle. I think the peak this year in the stock market is a peak we won't revisit for decades. However, I think we do, and I think we will have a cyclical recovery following the bust. And the bust probably doesn't last much more than 12 months, maybe 18 at the most. Bear market probably lasts, 8 to 10 months. So this is going to be quick. It's going to be steep and quick. And then I think by the second half of this decade, you've got a huge commodity cycle / industrial cycle, industrially driven cycle, that can take oil to $500 a barrel, can take gold to 20,000, can take silver to 500, can take all the commodities, including agricultural commodities, through the roof. You'll see 25% inflation by the end of the decade. When you put all that together, and at the same time, the $20 trillion, I'll just talk about the US, but the $20 trillion here will probably be matched in terms of debt coming out of the treasury. So you've ramped up and you're doing this all over the world. That 320 in global debt probably becomes something like 450 to 500 trillion by the early next decade. You can't, I know in the US, we have trouble funding or servicing our debt at 5%. Imagine if the long bonds at, you know, 16, 17, 18% and treasury bills are at 23, there's no way long before that, we're not going to be able to service that debt. So we're out of the capital markets. The central banks are out of the printing press game, because, you know, it'd be like, you know, having a fire hose with gasoline coming out of it in a California forest fire. You know, you can't, at a certain point, that inflation just going to keep going higher almost immediately if you're pumping more money. So they'll be shut out of the game. So in my opinion, it's the 2030s, you basically see the collapse of the world system. You know, I don't know exactly how the Chinese or the communists come out of this, but I don't think they're in any better shape. So I think it's basically worldwide collapse. I've made the statement that, you know, and again, it's totally guesswork and seat of the pants, but there's, again, this is scenario, not forecast, but I could see a scenario where there's 50% plus unemployment in this country, no Social Security or Medicare or very little, no unemployment benefits, no welfare system to speak of. The government's bankrupt. You know, it's a dire forecast. So getting back to CBDC, it's the question is, does this all happen so fast that their hands are full and they're, you know, they got too many other things to worry about that they never get to that? I worry terribly about, you know, central bank digital currency. I don't think it's coming in the next couple of years. And I think by the end of the decade, I'm not sure whether that's going to be a priority when they've got so much else going on.
So wouldn't gold be an asset that people would want if they're in a position where the financial system is imploding and they can't rely on the banks? I mean, if you're in a position of 50% unemployment, you're gonna need cash. But I don't know how the banking system would look in that environment. That could only be a full scale collapse of the banks and the banks not trusting each other. The system just wouldn't work. So you'd have to be outside the system. The only things that are outside the system potentially would be cryptocurrencies or gold and silver. Do you think they have any place at that point in that Armageddon?
I'm sure it's in small pockets. You know, I just don't see where, if you've got a systemic collapse of the worldwide system, you know, maybe things will come along, but I don't see where Bitcoin or crypto can take up that slack in any kind of magnitude, right? They'll be, it may do very well for those that are there, but I don't see how you can do the magnitudes to offset what I think is going to be a, you know, total systemic collapse. From a central bank or, you know, government controlled digital, I just don't, you know, I don't know how, you know, again, the banking system's collapsing. I'm not sure how the digital currency will make anything much better. You know, the control isn't going to be their biggest worry at that point, or if it is, it's going to be a totalitarian control that doesn't require digital currency, you know. And gold, I think gold certainly is a huge investment post-bust into this collapse. I just think everything collapses, you know, pretty much everything collapses in there. What comes out the other side, you know, it's going to be probably several years of pain. And then what comes out the other side is anybody's guess. Could be, you know, my fear would be it'd be totalitarian, you know, of some sort. But, you know, I don't think there's a, you know, I kind of think the Austrians think that you can kind of have a, let's get the collapse over with so we can start fresh and clean and do this right. I just don't see that as a likelihood, as a scenario that we run into.
During the Greek financial crisis, I remember Yanis Varoufakis, I believe his name, the then finance minister, was in discussions of leaving the European Union, and they were thinking of using something on the basis of the equivalent of their national insurance numbers. I not sure what you call it in America, but they were going to create a system where they were going to effectively start a new banking system or new currency based upon that. And they would do it. They were in the process of doing it. And then I think the then president, who was actually a friend of his, sort of said he was going to do it and then sort of went all political and for some reason didn't. The reason why I mention it is because it seems in a crisis, a lot can be done quickly because everybody's, you know, motivated to getting the problem solved. But the other reason for mentioning it was that Europe is always in the back of my mind as not being very stable because of the euro. And anyone who understands markets, they compare Europe to the US in the States. And they say, well, you know, you can have a single currency in America and separate states. And why can't we have that in Europe and et cetera, et cetera. Now, that's all well and good when the economy's doing well. The problem comes when the economies are pulling apart, which inevitably they do because not everybody has German discipline when it comes to monetary policy. And, you know, the Greek and the Italian and the Portuguese currencies were always declining just because of that reason, and balancing their economies by doing it meant things were cheaper, so money would flow. So it seems to be that this understanding or not understanding of how markets work led to the European project that's always on the brink. It's got to the brink and then it's sort of come back again, and it's got to the brink again. And now we've had Brexit, which is one step, but we're going to be in the currency anyway. And a lot of countries who were going to take up the euro but still be in Europe didn't do it because they kind of saw the light that it was a bad idea. You know, you've got the Czech Republic that hasn't got the euro. You've got Slovakia that has got the euro. I know they're just small economies, but it just goes to show Poland was definitely going to take it and then decided against it and went very anti-euro. And there's more anti-euro sentiment behind that. Do you think in this kind of collapse scenario, it's never the same, is it? Things are always different as to what triggers the collapse. In 2008, it was obviously the lending, the prime lending that was just off the charts, and, you know, ninja loans and all that sort of stuff that had been when we had financial instruments multiplying that, and everybody knows very, very well what happened there. But this time, it may be something like a country leaving the euro and then causing an upset just at the wrong time that then collapses the system. Do you have any view on where it might come from? And I know that's a difficult question.
Yeah, I'll separate out the 30s is, you know, still, I tell people don't stay up worrying about that one, because that's, you know, we have a lot to get through before we get there. But talking about the bust, which is in the next year, I think, I think there is a risk that the ECB or the euro doesn't make it through. Wow. It seems crazy to say that so near term, and it probably does somehow. They figure out how to patch it and keep it. But you're right. I mean, Italy and Spain, for example, you know, trying to keep those countries together when they don't have the ability to kind of flow the currency and, you know, devalue the currency and figure out a way to get through things. You know, when they're held to these strict measures and their economies are suffering. So, yeah, I think that's tough. You know, Germany's even, obviously, you know, your strong ones, Germany and France, are now not so strong. So I just think it's not an easy thing to hold that together, and it may not. I have said that, you know, in 2008-09, obviously it was the U.S. banks that led the whole worldwide situation. I said this time it's more likely to be led by the European banks, that, you know, our banks got, you know, were forced to get religion. So not that they're immune to the problems, but they're in better shape than most of the banks around the world today, the major banks, the big banks. So it's more likely Australia or Canada or Europe or even Asia is where the problems could be triggered. There's enough counterparty risk that I don't mean to say the U.S. is immune from it, what they're going to suffer. And certainly our regional banks with all the commercial real estate exposure could be a problem. But yeah, the, you know, people think the global bust has to be triggered here. I think it could easily be Europe. I mean, you guys have been through, you know, it's amazing to see what went on after, you know, after the pandemic and then the invasion of Ukraine and what went to, you know, what went on with energy prices and, you know, the loss of the Russian energy and to think you're still kind of muddling through is to me, underneath the surface, things are not good.
So your view on energy in the short term with all commodities going higher, am I right in saying that you think energy or oil is going to go down? And if it does, that would be a really interesting boost, an extra boost to the economy, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I've been, you know, I was caught like, I guess, others with the Russian invasion, and it spiked to 130. I've been bearish since 130. Caught a lot of flack while it was bouncing around there around 120. But I had said we'd go back to 85, and then, you know, when we got there, I said we can go to 60 or mid-60s. And I'm still saying that's kind of the next target is likely down to low 60s. And in the bust, I think oil can go to 30. So I, you know, doesn't mean it can't bounce up back up into the 80s before it goes to 60. I don't know what's going to do in the very short run, but it is kind of, people have struggled because they go, all your other call says dollar down, commodities up, and yet oil, you're saying oil down. And I go, yeah, it could tread water for a little while. I just think the supply demand situation out there in the world is a lot, there's a lot more supply than I think most of the street understood for a while. And, you know, so they missed it. Everybody was looking for $100 oil again. And certainly portfolio managers were all, you know, up until probably the last 6 months, maybe it was 9 months, but, you know, energy stocks were at the top of their list of most attractive groups. And I said, no, I just don't think so. There's, and I don't know whether long-term charts work, but if you put a 20 or 25-year chart up on, you know, XLE, it's a huge head and shoulder that you just rolled out of the right shoulder within the last year. And, you know, counts down to 20. I think, I don't know where it is now, 80 or wherever, but, or 85. But you know, I think energy will get hit hard in the bear market. And then, you know, coming out the other side, I'm very bullish on oil, but I just think for the next year, it's not looking too good.
So in terms of your analysis, you mentioned reading the tape, which for me is a giveaway that you're a price reader. Like, so you read price action and don't use, you know, things like oscillators and all that sort of stuff. Do you use any other, like Elliott Wave or GAN or anything like that, or are you just a pure chartist? Which is,
yeah, I would say I'm really a back of the napkin chartist. I'm not by any means a, you know, professional chartist, but I don't do point and figure. I don't do any of that. But yeah, I look at charts for sure. As I say, my calls, my analysis is, you know, fundamental and technicals, macro, cross markets. I think cross markets can tell you a lot. And then sentiment. And, you know, putting all that together, if I can get all of those to agree on a conclusion, then my convictions go up. If, you know, if it's only a couple of them, I don't have the convictions I have when everything's kind of telling me the same story. But I do, I'm being contrarian, I'm kind of opposite of the trend follower. You know, so like down here, you know, trend followers will tell you, forget about the metals, you know, forget about the miners. And yet this is what I'm attracted to the most is when they're down on their bottoms. And, you know, at the top, when, you know, momentum's strong, I'm going to be turning bearish on the market. So contrarian at both extremes, you know, both bullish and both at tops and bottoms, I tend to disagree with the chartists, but I'm looking at, you know, charts help me in terms of perspective, in terms of longer charts.
Yeah, I mean, it does depend. I mean, it depends how people are looking at charts, because I totally agree with the idea that you look at what's running, what's in trends, but you also, part of technical analysis isn't just looking at trends once they formed. It's looking at
right
the trends that are about to form, and yep. you don't take your eyes off those, because those are the ones that are up 20% before you've kind of noticed, and then it feels very hard to get in. So, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, it's funny. It kind of coincides with people, you know, because I'm a contrarian, they think I'm always contrary, and they go, "You're getting a lot of people agreeing with you, aren't you uncomfortable?" I go, "You have to understand, I'm very comfortable being the only bull at the bottom or the only bear at the top." And I said, "That's almost what it's like at the very turning point, is almost everybody disagrees with me." And I said, "For whatever reason, I'm comfortable being outside the crowd." But in that middle part, the consensus is often right. And I said, I'm going to be as consensus as anybody else in that middle part. And it's same thing with kind of relative strength, you know, like you said, that, you know, there's in the meat of the run, relative strength works great, but you just have to be careful at the turning points.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's how you measure it, which was what I was asking at the top about what you use for sentiment, because what I also noticed that in the .com crash, there's far more people actually talking about potential crash than you might think. The word crash gets used a lot. And I was quite surprised by that, because I was almost thrown slightly from it, because I was seeing all these signs that the market was going to crash. You know, there were people telling me how that they knew this guru who knew all the tech stocks to get into and how brilliantly they were doing, and there was this gung-ho air about it, and as I say, you know, people leaving their jobs and in order to trade, and we know it's a professional, very difficult thing to do. You can't just, you know, leave a job and suddenly start making money, because it's not going to work like that. You have to, you know, pay your dues and do your analysis.
Yeah, people are getting second mortgages and putting their money into .com stocks they don't know nothing about, you know.
It's possible if you're Nancy Pelosi, though.
Exactly.
But so, you know, those, but then at that time also, surprisingly, there were a few people saying, oh, you know, in the main media, which threw me slightly, as I was saying, they were talking about a potential crash. And I was thinking, you know, markets don't crash when people are talking about a crash. But actually, it gets to that point where it's almost like a completely crazed party where nobody's listening to the fact that the place is on fire and they need to get out. But there are a few voices just going, oh, hang on a minute, this doesn't look right. Let's get out of here. And so
there are always some people that have discipline and say, you know, this is insane. You know, I can't possibly make sense of this, and I'm, you know, I think this is going to end very badly. But it's that, you know, that majority that, and I say this to people now who, you know, talk about selling, you know, when we see what you're calling for, I'm getting out. And I go, you have to understand, at the top, it's going to be a very compelling story that's going to make it hard to sell. Oh, you know, sure. Everybody thinks it's going to be an easy sell. When we get there, I'm getting out. And I go, that's not how it works.
Yeah, markets fall out of a blue sky. In media picks, I think we're going to find a book that you recommend in terms of the financial markets. But I can just sort of feel that there'll be people who want to learn how you've kind of married these principles together, and whether there's any way that you actually either teach it or what steps they might need to do in order to replicate your method of analysis.
Yeah, what I tell people is it's the five things I listed before is how I approach it. But I'm on Twitter every day, and I'm basically retired, so I'm on Twitter every day with the idea of, you know, retail public in particularly is exposed to all this stuff out there. Most of it, you know, turns out to be 180 degrees wrong, because the consensus, you know, can be wrong. They get caught in all the narratives and all that. And I just said, I can, you know, when I started doing this several years ago, I just want to be a voice that kind of counters that. It doesn't mean I'm always right, or it doesn't mean I have all the answers, but at least you're getting an alternative view that can make you think and, you know, consider another narrative. So that's what I, and through, You know, over the years, it used to be I initiated tweets more, but in the last few years, most of it's replies, and I might have 50 or 100 replies a day, like yesterday. And I think if people pay attention to those replies, you know, the reply is to somebody, but the replies are really meant to educate. You know, there's not every reply, but there's a lot of things in there that if you accumulate that view can help you kind of understand markets better. And certainly a lot of it comes from a contrarian perspective and from the standpoint that, you know, listen to the market, but don't get, you know, caught up in momentum, that kind of thing. But that's sort of how I teach. I don't think if somebody said, sit down and tell me how I get this. I mean, people will direct message me and say, will you mentor me? Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I'm sorry. You know, I've got grandkids. I've got other things I do in my life. I'm busy enough doing what I do on Twitter. But you know, if you pay attention to that, I think it's a form of mentoring the masses in terms of what I do. So, you know, it's not everybody's cup of tea. You know, some people really don't like that I am not, you know, a trend follower or what have you, but it's a different voice.
But obviously you can't really care what other people think, right? Because that's not, it's well known that the most sort of popular research is often the research that's wrong. And by dint of the way the markets work, as soon as people are agreeing with you too much, you know there's a problem. So I worry when people agree with me. That was always my thing. And so, you know, the 2007, well, I call it 2007 crisis, but I was working in a bank and saying what I could see from both the technical and, you know, kind of logical point of view as to what was going on. And you just see how people who've been educated in classic economics get it wrong, because, you know, the Bank of England, they were worried about inflation. So they wanted to keep, oil was going up and they wanted to move interest rates up higher. And you just see the banking system's imploding and nobody's looking at, and everyone who's using economics is just looking at the unemployment numbers and saying, oh, they're fine. It's like, you know, just absolutely crazy. It's absolutely crazy. But nobody really wanted to listen that things weren't as good as they thought they were. And that was a real contrary call, because no, I could find virtually nobody who agreed. And the mistake I made after that was I stayed very bearish, to be honest. I was, I think it was a feeling that the markets hadn't really dealt with the problem that they'd seen. And inherently, I felt like that was wrong and there needed to be some form of correction. But in terms of technicals, the technicals were like pointing to the market going higher. It was one of the few times when I was like ignoring my core method of analysis and thinking this can't continue, which is, that is a lesson as well, that sometimes you kind of, your instincts seem to override what you feel should happen.
And yeah, I think when you go back to 2009 and look at where we were, you felt there was another shoe to drop, right? Yeah. It just didn't seem like we had, and even for people like you or I who know the markets discount things ahead and move ahead, it just didn't seem like it was, you know, we had dealt with the problems in the way we needed to yet. But
yeah, 1987, I could have understood more, because that was concentrated on a lot of speculation. It hadn't permeated the whole market. Whereas 2008, it felt like there were so many people who were caught up in it. And all the banks were caught up in it. Every bank, one way or another, was caught up in it, whether they liked it or not. It just felt like they've just papered over the cracks here. They haven't dealt with this problem at all. They're kicking the can down the road, to use the expression that's been used ever since then. And at some point it's got to come home to roost, and perhaps we are actually within shouting distance of that situation now, which is, it's a very interesting timing that you've come on to talk about that potential that's coming up now. But David, all I would say is that you know it's been absolutely fantastic having you on the show, and I would very much like you to come back on. But before we sort of wrap things up, was there anything that we didn't mention that you'd like to mention to our listeners?
I guess just probably, you know, we did talk about interest rates, but just understand there's going to be a period here where I think the stocks, bonds, and the metals markets are all going to be moving up together. And we don't get that often. You know, everybody's trying to figure out which of the markets can move. And I think we're almost in that sweet spot pretty soon here where you're going to get all three of those moving up together. And that's okay.
Right. Brilliant. Tim, any final comments before we go to media picks?
And nothing to add.
Okay, great. What is your media pick for us then, Tim?
I think I'm going to struggle to match whatever David is going to pull out of the fire, but I'm going to give it a go. It's not so much a media pick as a person. I don't know if I've mentioned the guy Eckhart Tolle
yes.
before.
Yes.
But I got into him probably a year or so ago with a book called The Power of Now, which I guess is, I suppose my thesis is that we're engaged at some level in some kind of spiritual war in terms of what's going on in the economy and in geopolitics. And for people who, I mean, I think David's also given us plenty of reasons to be concerned about the future. The future, of course, never technically exists. So this is the beauty of the Eckhart Tolle book, The Power of Now, which is he advocates living in the now and appreciating the now for what it is, which is, I appreciate it's going to sound a little bit strange for a sort of financial related podcast, but I suppose what I'm looking for, and I think what a lot of people are looking for, is some kind of comfort, some kind of inner peace at a time of extreme change and extreme discomfort. And so there's an audiobook that I came across on Spotify that I've started listening to, and it's by Eckhart Tolle, and it's called Stillness and Rising Above Thought, which is it's very, 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 I suppose it gives you a lot of spiritual solace. And if I could just put one idea of Eckhart's, he sort of distills lots of wisdoms from a lot of different religions, Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, Hinduism, and so on. I think the one thing that I'm starting to appreciate is that the one of the biggest problems with humanity is that we have this, what Eckhart would call this egoic identity, which is basically the self. And the egoic identity is intimately tied up with the brain, which is constantly sending us thoughts, most of which are distractions and dangerous and not required. So if you can find some form of inner peace and effectively suppress the egoic identity, you will be a lot happier as a person, which I appreciate is a slightly strange thing to be coming out with, but I found it enormously valuable to discover this gentleman Eckhart Tolle, and I'd recommend him to anybody.
I totally agree. I was listening to his audiobook of The Power of Now, and it was fascinating. It really was. And I think it's for anyone who's involved in the financial markets, recognizes the kind of stresses that are involved pulling you in different directions and the mental game that it is, obviously having interactions with people who disagree with you, having your calls and having the market kind of either agree or disagree with you. It is stressful, and life is stressful on top of that. This is why trading is so difficult and investing, but anything that can help with your personal wellness is very valuable, especially I would say. So I'd say it's a, you know, very good thing to be looking at, and one that's often overlooked when it comes to the holistic element of investing and trading. That's brilliant, and thank you. David, what did you have for us?
Yeah, mine's a bit more mundane, I guess, but I have suggested this many times on Twitter. Back in 1977, I read a book when I was, you know, my first few years in the business. I was already a contrarian, but I read a book. It was at that time, I think it was called The Psychology of the Stock Market, and it has had many new edits or new editions since then. And I think the latest one might have been in 1998. So it's an old book called, and the title changed. So it's Contrarian Investment Strategies, I think it's pretty much the same content. It was written by a fellow by the name of David Dreeman, who was a longtime columnist for Forbes magazine, had his own money management firm in New York, or actually Jersey City, and was a Canadian, but very much a contrarian. And I remember reading, and I haven't read it since, but I remember reading it in 1977 and saying, it just, you know, it was easy to read for me because it was speaking my language, but it was also laid out in such an easy format, an easy way to understand the concept that psychology drives the market, or is a very big component of the market. And so I think for any retail investor, and frankly, I think some professionals could probably benefit from it too, to just understand the power of psychology in the markets. And again, it's a kind of an oldie but a goodie, but I think one that should be must reading for anybody new to investing, at least.
Did you say he was an anchor? Because I think I've read it actually, but it was a very long time ago when I read it, so I can't remember whether it's the same book.
Did I say what? Was he?
Was the author, was he an anchor? Was he a financial anchor on one of the main?
He was for Forbes magazine, he was a columnist.
Oh, right. Okay. So
you probably might have seen him in there, and he probably wrote, for other publications at times, and may have appeared on, certainly could have appeared on Wall Street Week or any of those back then.
Right.
But definitely a contrarian at heart, and, lived it in his money management firm as well.
Right. Brilliant. Well, mine's just going to be pure sort of entertainment. So I'm going to choose something I saw on Netflix, which was recommended to me, and I've never seen anything like this before, is all I can say. It's a three-part documentary, but each part is only 45 minutes, so you could burn through it in an evening. And once I started watching it, I couldn't stop watching it. It's called An American Nightmare, and it's about the kidnapping. This lady was kidnapped, and it's the story behind what happened. Her partner gave a story to the police. He didn't actually report it for a few hours afterwards, which they found very suspicious. And what happens afterwards is just, you couldn't make it up. You just really couldn't. It's fact is greater than fiction in that regard. So it's pure entertainment, but just incredible. And actually speaks, I don't know, relate everything back to markets one way or the other, but it just seems to fit in with how whatever you look at, you've got to also, question what you're seeing, because it's never as straightforward. And I think that's a good lesson to come out from that documentary. But I'm sure, people will enjoy it, because I've so far, everyone who's watched it has just messaged me afterwards going, oh my God. David, thank you so much for being so generous with your time. And just before we wrap this up, what is your Twitter handle for people who are listening? And I couldn't find a website for you or something that people can sign up to, but I believe people can do that by messaging you.
Yeah, I am on Twitter most days. So my handle on Twitter is at Dave H. Contrarian. So not David, Dave H. Contrarian. And I caution people, as we all know, Twitter is full of these fake accounts. So people will change a letter in Contrarian or what have you, and use my profile to make it look like me. And I just tell people, I've got 196,000 followers. Most of these fake accounts don't have 1,000 followers. So look at that first. I don't have more than one account. There's only that one account. So, just beware, because it's easy to get fooled. I had somebody this week say, did you recommend something? I said, I don't recommend anything as a strategist. I just forecast. So they said, I got pulled in. So that's where they can find me. I do write a quarterly investment letter, macro-based letter that's by subscription. And I tell people they can direct message me on Twitter, just DM me there, and I will respond with details about cost and what's involved, what what is included in that letter.
Great. Absolutely fantastic. We'll put a link in the show notes. It would obviously be the correct handle, but as you said, just watch out for people doing these fake, anyone who's got lots of followers, they seem to proliferate these fake accounts. So just be very, very careful. David, once again, just thank you so much for coming on, and hopefully you could come back on again. Sure. In a little while.
Linda's through the wreckage.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, that's right. You can maybe 6 months from now, we can look back and say, either you got a lot of that right, or gee, what were you thinking?
Exactly. You know, it's no one's got everything right 100%, and I think people need to understand that as well. You know, the market is a fluid environment, and things change, and you can only give your best view at that time.
Well, as I say, you're forecasting the future. You know, you're going to get some things right, but you're certainly going to get lots of things wrong too. So.
Absolutely. But once again, thank you so much for coming on the show, and we look forward to having you back.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks, Paul. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks,
David.
We had an online question about David Hunter's history in the markets, and because he was kind enough to give us a very comprehensive answer, I decided to put it at the end of the podcast in order for the people who are interested to jump to. So here it is. From when you started in the markets, have you worked in any sort of major, for any major banks or institutions, or have you been mentored by anyone who we may know as names in the markets, or have you just learned everything yourself?
Yeah, it's, I started, I went to school in the Midwest, and, small, not a big school. And when I came out in 73 and wanted to go to Wall Street, it wasn't an easy thing to do from where I was at. So I took whatever I could get into investments. And I was out in Indiana. Indiana at that time had countywide branching in banks. You couldn't have statewide branching. So I went to the largest bank in my county, in the town I was going to school in. The largest county bank there had an investment department, one-man shop. He wanted to make it a two-man shop, so I got hired. The best thing I could do, because I was given responsibilities very early on. I was doing asset liability stuff for the bank. So I was doing both trust work, which was meant stocks and investing for people, but also bank work, which was the bond side, and asset liability. That we had an asset liability committee, and I was sitting in on that at 22 years old. And so I had great exposure to kind of stuff that turned me into a real macro guy early on. Spent 4 years there, went to school at night in Chicago, so I'd leave Northwest Indiana, grab a Big Mac, and go into the loop in Chicago at 6 o'clock at night. And, it was a 3-hour class, and then be back home and go to work the next day. So I did that for 2.5 years, got my MBA. And then I, after 4 years, left there and went back to regional bank in Connecticut. That's where I realized how unique my experience was, because there, even though it wasn't a massive bank, it was large for the state of Connecticut, but it was, you had to choose. You were either going to do bank portfolio or do trust. And so I did, I was more on the trust side then. And from there, where my career kind of took off is I took a job with Textron as their in-house equity manager. And this is an interesting story in that it was 1981. They had been beat up in the 73-4 market because their pension funds were invested in the New York banks. G. William Miller was chairman of Textron at the time. He went on to be Fed chairman under Jimmy Carter, and in my opinion was the worst Fed chairman in history. But he was a very smart financier. Textron was the original conglomerate, so they were doing private placements and all kinds of stuff as a conglomerate. They were buying up other companies. So they, when their portfolios in the banks during the bear market went down, and he said, I got guys close to retirement, and I have to tell them their pension assets are in half. He goes, I never want to do that again. So he pulled all the money out of the banks, brought it in-house, and they ran in their pension funds like they ran their company. It was private placements, bonds, and a little bit of equity. But then they missed the oil market in the late 70s, early 80s, when and their top quartile performance in the time they had brought it out of the banks dropped to 50 percentile. So they said, we can't be out of equities. We missed, you know, it's hurting our performance. So I was brought in, I was, you know, barely 30 years old, brought in to run their equities. They had 10% of their assets in equities. I, in the next 4 years, I showed them, and G. William Miller had left there to go to the Fed. So he was not there when I got there, but his ghost was there. So I went to investment committees, and this was in, you know, I joined them in December of 81. I told them to keep their powder dry until August of 82. I went into an investment committee and said, it's time to go. And we were at the bottom of the market. They had 10% of their assets in equities, and it was almost private placement equities. They were, you know, value things that were out of favor and not really traded much. I started building a portfolio, and I went to them and said, you know, can we put $100 million into the market? And they gave me a $50 million. And I came out of that meeting upset. My boss said, you don't know how lucky, you know, that's a big step for them. And they're preaching to me the ghost of, you know, G. William Miller said, we should never do this. You know, we need to be careful here. It's a, for, to make a long story short, over the next 4 years, I had top one percentile, 4.5 years, top one percentile performance for all those years in the, you know, the pension fund index, the SEI pension fund index. I was top one percentile. You know, outperformed the indexes by 700 basis points a year, and took them from 10% equities to 50%. Their equity, their pension portfolio doubled in that time because they had done an acquisition. So I had, you know, all of a sudden they didn't know what hit them. I mean, it was only the performance obviously made it easier, but I mean, they had never ever intended to go equity strong like that, but it was, the performance was so off the wall. So I went from there, leveraged me. I went from there to Fidelity. I was, worked in Fidelity when Peter Lynch was there. Wasn't mentored by Peter, but I was, you know, certainly one of the portfolio managers when he was there. I was on the international side. So I was running pension funds that were globally diversified. And Fidelity was kind of unique in this way. They had their local managers running the various, so they had a, you know, a European, they had a couple guys based in Britain running the European part of the portfolio, people in Asia running or Australia running some of that. We were running the US portion of global portfolios. So I had, and I had all, you know, foreign accounts. So I had British Leyland and Westland Helicopter and Rolls Royce and let's see, some Australian accounts were equivalent to their Social Security fund. And some banks in Japan, et cetera. So it was, you know, I wasn't in the mutual fund area, but I was certainly, you know, rubbing elbows with those guys too. And it was interesting because I was there through the 87 crash.
I was going to ask you about that, how you dealt with that.
I was fine because I was, you know, well, I had a lot of, I was hitting, because of my value bet, I was buying a lot of things that were, during that time in the, you know, in the mid 80s, all of a sudden these things were, and some of them I was buying off, you know, I was seeing them in charts and doing my homework, but there were things that were like Fruhoff and American Standard and things, and they were getting, the raters were getting them. I wasn't buying them to be rated or anything, you know, the leveraged buyouts were going after them and stuff, but I wasn't buying them for that. And all of a sudden 87 hit and those got hit. So that was a little bit of a, you know, a tough time for a couple months, but generally what I took away from 87 was watching Fidelity was, you know, growing like a weed at that time. They were the place to be. You know, everybody wanted to be at Fidelity, and they had come up with the sector funds. They were early on in that, and they had, you know, 25-year-old kids fresh out of business school running these sector funds because they brought them in to be analysts. And then as analysts, they got to run sectors, you know, their area. So these 25-year-old kids are talking to the, you know, chairman of IBM or General Motors or, you know, Microsoft, what have you. And then 87 hit, and I saw these kids who thought they were masters of the universe. I mean, they, you know, they didn't understand the reason their performance was doing so well, and they were doing so well, was a bull market. And when their portfolios just got decimated, I mean, they were in tears. I mean, it was like it just was a real comeuppance. So they learned a hard lesson. And it was just because they were so new and so young and were handed responsibility so quickly. But anyway, that was just kind of that. And then I went on to be head of equities, head of active equities at ITT Hartford, which became Hartford Insurance Group. And then was a CIO of a billion-dollar money management firm in New York. And then the second half of the career was as a macro strategist. So it's been kind of a, you know, half money manager and half macro strategist. And I always say, having had that first half really makes me a better strategist, because I actually had to manage money.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. Please do your own research or contact a professional advisor.